Chapter 30. 31st of October, 3 a.m. 3 hours until low tide. The tape comes to an abrupt end and ejects itself. Then the 80 clocks out in the hall inform us that it is 3 a.m. We all wait for the noise to stop. "I don't think we learned anything at all from watching that nonsense," says Lily when it is quiet again. "Maybe not," says Rose, putting down the remote. I stare at it and can't help wondering if she stopped the tape just now, and whether there might have been more to see. "But this will be the first hour that someone didn't go missing, so I think we did the right thing by staying together in one room."
"What do you mean?" asks Lily.
"Well, Nana was..."
She looks at Trixie and senses herself.
"Found at midnight. Dad at 1 a.m. We found Trixie at 2.
"You can all stop pretending. I'm not a child," says Trixie. Though in pink pyjamas and with her mess of curls, she does look like one.
"I've guessed that I didn't just faint and that something happened to me too."
"We didn't want you to be scared," says Lily.
"Why not? It's obvious you all are,"
Trixie replies, staring at her mother.
"If Rose is right, and someone planned to do something to one of us, on the hour, every hour, then we're due another incident," says Connor.
"Well, I make it 3:03, so maybe we're safe now," says Lily.
"Maybe," Rose replies, sounding uncertain. She stares at Poppins, who is lying upside down, stretched out in front of the fire. It's one of the old dog's favourite spots in the house. Poppins hasn't moved or made a sound for quite some time. We exchange looks, and then Rose speaks in that special voice she only uses for animals.
"Poppins?"
The dog doesn't move.
"Poppins!"
Rose tries again. Nothing.
"Wakey, wakey, Poppins," says Trixie.
Rose turns a whiter shade of pale when there is still no response.
"Poppins,"
she tries one last time.
"Do you want din-dins?"
The dog goes from upside down to up on all fours and wagging her tail in seconds, and we breathe a communal sigh of relief.
"Oh, thank God," says Rose.
"It's less than 3 hours until low tide now. We just have to stay calm. Then we can all get out of here. Together."
Connor starts checking that the doors and windows are locked again. It's Lily's turn to pace up and down the room, and Rose sits in Nana's purple armchair, quietly playing with the ring on her right hand. It's made of 3 interlocking bands, of bronze, silver and gold, and was a gift from Nana on Rose's 16th birthday. It's something that I've always been jealous of, like so many of the things my sisters had that I didn't. I remember that birthday and that year very well. It was 1986. Nana and Nancy were both wearing aprons, which was a recipe for disaster, seeing as Nana didn't like anyone else in the kitchen when she was cooking. But Nancy insisted on helping with her daughter's 16th birthday cake. Lily, the lover of all things sweet, marched into the room where I had been sitting quietly and stuck her hand into the bowl of chocolate icing before licking her finger clean. Lily still had short hair, but it had grown into a bob by then, so she looked like a miniature version of our mother. Rose was allowed to have a sleepover at Sea Glass with some of her closest friends for her 16th birthday. She would soon be attending a different school, and I think in many ways it was a chance to say goodbye. Things were never quite the same between my sisters after the hair-cutting incident. But Lily was not looking forward to life at boarding school without Rose, and clung to her side that summer like a barnacle. She was our sister's shadow, but was never in it. She followed Rose everywhere, always wanting to be one step ahead. but she couldn't follow Rose to a school for gifted students because she wasn't one. I remember the conversation Nana and Nancy had about my dad, and for the first time, I didn't really care whether he made an appearance or not. He wasn't there for all of my birthdays. "If he said he'll be here, he'll be here," said Nana, defending her son. Nancy sighed. "Well, it isn't long before the kids arrive. Then the tide will be in, and then he'll be too late. You can't be there for one daughter's birthday and not there for the other. Rose will feel so let down if he's a no-show again." "Just be patient," Nana said. "And as for the other one, he'll be back. Men don't like being told off. It makes them sulk, like the little boys they're pretending not to be. All I asked was for Bradley to wipe his feet before trudging in mud from the garden. It's as though he can't see the dirt." I remember my mother and Connor's father squabbling about the strangest of things when they were friends. Being neat and tidy frequently seemed to be high on their list of differences. She was. He wasn't. Nancy was always tidying things away and putting them in cupboards. Connor's dad's inability to remove his muddy gardening boots before stepping inside made her crazier than normal.
"Daisy," Nancy said, "leave the cake mix alone."
"Lily stuck her finger in the bowl. Why can't I? And why can't I stay up for the party? I'm almost 11, said 10-year-old me.
"Because I said so. Rose wants to have a sleepover with some friends. They're all a bit older than you, sweetheart. You can stay for the food, then straight up to your room. Nana and I are forbidden from staying downstairs too," my mother said.
"You'll understand one day." I didn't believe her. Like all children whose parents get divorced, my sisters and I learned to adapt to our new lives. Rose and Lily learned to love going to boarding school, and soon seemed to resent their long summers back at Seaglass with me. Despite the unpleasantness they unpacked with their bags, I always longed for their return. I missed them. They shared a life that I had little knowledge of, filled with teachers and friends and lessons. I would listen to their stories with little understanding of what they meant. For years, I thought that a spelling test was something only trainee witches had to do to check they had learned their magic spells. I wondered if that's what my sisters really were, witches. There had been plenty of evidence to suggest I was right. I resented their relationship and was jealous of their education, and the older I got, the more being left behind bothered me. My mother's idea of homeschooling was to allow me to read the books Nana gave me. She wouldn't even let me watch the news on TV, only cartoons like Bugs Bunny. "Daisy doesn't need to learn about the horrors of the real world," Nancy would say, depriving me of the joy of learning. So I tried to teach myself. This Daisy was a self-raising flower. But my life was too quiet without my sisters in it. I was almost always alone, with nothing but novels and an overactive imagination for company. Books can take you anywhere if you let them, and reading proved to be a big part of my education. But my sisters learned a lot of things that I didn't. Things about real life and social skills and boys. I have always been a little awkward around real people. I don't know how to talk to them, and even now I still prefer the company of characters in books. I suppose it is a hangover from my childhood, when I was so often drunk with solitude. Doesn't play well with others is to be expected when playing with others was rarely an option. And I have always been a little over the limit with my own opinions, without the views of others to dilute them. "Can I watch Labyrinth again?" I asked Nancy, when she tried to shoo me out of the kitchen for the 10th time. It was my favourite film that year, and Connor had managed to get me a bootlegged copy. But my sisters only wanted to watch Top Gun and drool over Tom Cruise, so I had to watch it on my own. "Yes, but not tonight, because the only TV is downstairs, as you well know. Go on, skedaddle," she said, wearing her enormous shoulder pads. A very strange invention, then and now. She started blowing up a blue balloon and left the room.
Don't waste your life being sad about things you can't change, Nana said when my mother was gone.
I'm just sick of being such a loser, I replied.
Lily had started calling me that name on a regular basis and always made an L shape on her forehead when she did. She called me a loser so often I had started to believe that I was one.
Rose will go off to university one day. Connor will probably be a brilliant journalist. And I want that to happen for him. He's so talented. He deserves it.
Don't spend all of your ambition on other people's dreams, said Nana.
Why not? What kind of future do I have to look forward to? I'm a nobody.
She smiled and shook her head. The only nobodies in this world are the people who pretend to be somebody. The people who think they are better than other people because of the way they choose to look, or speak, or vote, or pray, or love. People are not the same but different. They are different but the same.
I was too young to understand what she meant at the time, but I think I do now.
And Daisy, Nana said, as we heard the sound of people arriving at the front door.
Yes, Nana?
Best to leave the scissors in the drawer this family birthday.
She knew.
Nana knew that it was me who cut off Lily's hair, but she had never said anything about it before. I've no idea what my face did. I've never had much control over the expressions it pulls, but the rest of me froze.
Nana smiled.
I'll always keep your secrets, my darling girl, and you'll always be my favourite. You just have to prove all those doctors wrong for me. As for your sisters, Albert Einstein once said that weak people revenge, strong people forgive, and intelligent people ignore. It was one of the few things he was wrong about. Success is the best revenge. Try to remember that.
Before she could say any more on the subject, a small but perfectly formed group of 15 and 16-year-olds arrived at Seaglass. They had been shepherded across the causeway like lost sheep by Rose before the tide came in. Every one of them was dressed to impress. The only teenager I recognized amongst them was Connor, doing a not bad impression of Tom Cruise in Top Gun. He wore aviator sunglasses indoors, even when it got dark, so was constantly bumping into things and people, but he thought he looked cool. I was allowed to stay downstairs until Rose blew out the 16 candles on her birthday cake. Nancy, with a lot of help from Nana, had created a magic-looking Malteser cake, which looked like the bag of chocolates was hovering in midair. The number 16 was spelled in chocolate balls, too. It really was very impressive. When the bowls were all cleared away, Rose started opening her presents, surrounded by friends and people who loved her. My mother gave her a beautiful pale blue designer dress, and I felt the jealousy growing inside me until it hurt. But I wasn't the only one. Lily looked at that dress as though it should have been hers, which might be why Rose immediately put it away in her wardrobe upstairs. When Rose opened Nana's present, the bronze, silver and gold ring that Rose still wears today, I remember how hard it was not to cry. The ring was so beautiful, just like my sister. I wished it was mine.
Time for bed now, Daisy, my mother said in front of everyone,
and I hated her a little bit. I didn't feel like a child, even though I was one, and I didn't like the way she spoke to me in front of everyone else. I was old enough by then to notice that my mother always wanted to hide me away from the world, as though I was something to be ashamed of. At least, that's how it felt. 10-year-old me did go upstairs, but I didn't go to bed as instructed. Instead, I sneaked into my sister's bedroom, while everyone else was having too much fun downstairs to realize. I opened their wardrobe and found the pale blue dress my mother had given Rose for her birthday. The tags were still attached. I didn't care that it didn't belong to me, or that it was several sizes too big.
I was sick of wearing hand-me-downs that were years old and faded from being washed too many times. I put the dress on and admired my own reflection. Disappointed by what I saw, I borrowed one of Lily's bras, stuffed it with socks, and pulled the dress over my head again. I looked better, even if one fake boob was bigger and higher than the other. Next, I stole a pair of shoes, kitten heels that were too big and impossible to walk in, but that didn't bother me. I never knew my shoe size as a child because I always just wore the shoes Rose and Lily had grown out of. I borrowed some of my sister's makeup. Applying it wasn't something I was good at, having never been shown, but I'd give myself an A for effort. Then I backcombed my hair. I'm still not sure why anyone ever thought this looked good, but in 1986, big hair was cool. I sprayed a can of hairspray all over the creature on top of my head until I made myself cough and admired the finished result in the mirror. My face was a shock of pink lipstick and blue eyeshadow. My hair looked as though I had stuck my fingers in a socket. But the blue dress was beautiful, and I liked what I saw. Not sure what to do next, but still in the mood to do things I knew I shouldn't, I opened Rose's diary, which she kept by her bed. I understood that what she wrote inside was private, but I wanted to know everything about the lives that my sisters got to lead. I found one of Rose's Hush poems, scribbled on a scrap of paper, hidden between the pages, and I sang it out loud. Hush, little baby, don't say a word. Mama's gonna buy you a mockingbird. And if that mockingbird does scream, Mama's gonna trap you inside a dream. And if that dream is a scary place, Mama's gonna put a pillow over your face. Hush, little baby, don't you cry. Sometimes we live, sometimes we die. There were magazines spread across Lily's side of the room. She loved Just 17. And there were a pair of scissors on top of an open page, where she had been cutting out the faces of her favourite boy bands and sticking them to the wall. Lily was obsessed with boys by then, and to be fair, they were fairly obsessed with her in return. I could hear my sisters and their friends playing a game downstairs in the hall, so crept out onto the stairs so that I could listen. The game involved striped drinking straws, the kind Nana normally used for homemade lemonade. The rules of the game seemed hard to follow, but the boys picked blue and white straws, the girls picked red and white ones, and the boy and girl with the shortest straws were locked in the cupboard under the stairs for 1 minute. The cupboard with no light. And mice. And spiders. But spiders aren't the only ones to spin webs to catch their victims. I peered down at them all through the banister, and it didn't look like a fun game to me. When Rose and Connor chose the short straws and were locked inside, Lily looked very upset. The group of 10 or so teenagers were all counting down the seconds and giggling, and I couldn't resist slowly creeping down the stairs to get a closer look. When the clocks in the hallway all struck midnight, the kids all screamed. Lily unlocked the cupboard. But Rose and Connor didn't come out. They were too busy kissing.
Look, it's the real Daisy Darker, said a boy I'd seen staring at me earlier.
He looked like he ate too many chocolate bars. Nobody else noticed me at all. They were too busy staring at Rose and Connor. I guess I'm one of those people who other people just don't see. Lily was crying in the corner of the hallway for some reason. The mascara she had been wearing had leaked down her cheeks in a series of inky tears. Rose and Connor were still kissing, as though the rest of us weren't there. And I decided that it was time for bed after all. I ran up the stairs and back into my sister's bedroom, pulling off the blue designer dress. I could still hear all the clocks striking midnight down in the hall, and they sounded louder than normal. That's when I noticed the scissors on top of Lily's pile of magazines again. I didn't really think about it. Didn't hesitate. I shredded that blue dress so that Rose would never, ever get to wear it. Then I put the thin strands of silky blue material in her bed, hiding them beneath her pillow. I put the scissors on Lily's bedside table and left everything else exactly as I found it. Lily got the blame, and a silent war started between my sisters. Everyone thought it was an act of revenge. They were right about that part.
Chapter 31. 31st of October, 3:15 a.m. Less than 3 hours until low tide. Back in the present, I think I'm the first to hear a noise spoiling what should be silence. It's the sound of ringing in the distance, like an old-fashioned alarm clock.
Can anyone else hear that?
I whisper.
What is that? Lily asks.
I don't hear anything, says Connor.
I can hear it,
Trixie says.
So can I.
Shh,
listen,
says Rose. We all strain to hear the sound coming from somewhere outside the lounge, possibly outside the house. Nobody has left the room since Rose went to the bathroom.
I'll go, she says.
The gun in Rose's hand is a surreal sight to see. Connor shakes his head and picks up the torch.
No, we'll all go. We should stay together, he says.
Without another word, we all leave the room, except for Poppins, who is fast asleep again by the fire. Connor and I lead the way, with the rest following close behind, so close that Rose nearly walks right into me. Lily is holding Trixie's hand. I doubt she'll let her out of her sight again after what happened earlier. We follow the sound of ringing to the kitchen. The back door is open, letting in the rain. The door bangs loudly and the gust of wind that is battering it blows a swirl of dead leaves inside. One by one, we all look up at the chalk poem on the wall and see that, once again, some lines have been struck out. Daisy Darker's Nana was the oldest but least wise. The woman's will made them all feel ill, which was why she had to die. Daisy Darker's father lived life dancing to his own tune. His self-centered ways and the pianos he played danced him to his doom. Daisy Darker's mother was an actress with the coldest heart. She didn't love all her children and deserved to lose her part. Daisy Darker's niece was a precocious little child. Like all abandoned ducklings, she would not fare well in the wild. The wind outside howls like a choir of ghosts.
Why is my name crossed out?
Trixie asks in a small voice.
Nancy has been crossed out too,
Lily whispers. Rose tries to reassure them both. It might not mean anything.
Of course it means something,
Lily snaps.
And I think we all know what that might be. We should have looked for Nancy. We should have done something. Oh, my God,
Lily says, staring at Rose and taking a step away from our sister.
It was you. You're the only one who left that room, and now more of the poem has been crossed out. You were always making up weird rhymes when we were children. It was you, all of it. You injected Trixie and then pretended to fix her. How could you? Why would you?
Injected me with what? Whispers Trixie.
It wasn't me, says Rose. Where is Nancy?
Lily shouts.
I don't know. I don't believe you. You were the one who said we shouldn't look for her, and now I know why.
Lily steps in front of her daughter, who looks terrified. Rose takes a step towards them, and we all stare at the gun in her hand.
Stay away from my child, says Lily. I didn't do anything,
Rose replies, hiding the gun behind her back.
Wait, says Connor. You stay out of this. You're probably helping her. I don't trust any of you,
Lily says.
This isn't the time to start turning on one another.
Connor replies gently.
Why not? Lily snaps. He holds his hands up in surrender. Because look at the footprints.
We all stare down at the floor then and see what he is talking about. There are muddy footprints leading to and from the back door. It reminds me of all the times Connor's dad forgot to take off his gardening boots when he came to visit. The dirt Bradley Kennedy dragged inside drove my mother mad. I look at Rose's feet and the small, pristine white trainers she is wearing. Only a pair of large, muddy boots could have made this mess. The sound of an alarm keeps ringing in the distance, and the open kitchen door that leads to the garden bangs on its hinges again, battered by the wind. We all watch in silence as Connor starts walking towards it.
Please don't go out there, I say.
He hesitates, but then steps outside into the rain, turning on the torch. He picked it up when we were all still in the lounge, even though the power is back on now. Almost as though he knew he might have to go out in the dark. My sisters and I watch from the doorway as Connor walks out onto the patio, slowly shining the torch around the garden. The beam is too faint to light up the sea crashing on the rocks beyond the wall, only illuminating a meter or so ahead. The rain is light but persistent now, as though the sky is spitting in Connor's face. But he moves through the gloom until the torchlight stops on the bench in the distance. It's where my mother always liked to sit and admire her flowers, beneath the magnolia tree she planted here with Connor's dad. The tree that Nana thought was a symbol of hope always looks a little bit dead in winter. The old magnolia is the only tree on our tiny tidal island, and has grown quite big over the last 20 years. Fat raindrops cling to its bare branches, giving an illusion of miniature lights, and it's so cold I wonder if they might freeze before they fall. I can't quite process what I am seeing when I spot my mother sitting on her garden bench, wearing her black silk eye mask on her face, the one she always wears to help her sleep. Outside, in the dark, in the rain. Nancy? Connor calls, his voice a little strangled by the sound of the sea. He walks towards her and the rest of us start to follow.
What's wrong with her?
Why is she sitting in the rain wearing an eye mask? Trixie asks.
Go back inside, Lily says. Stand in the doorway where I can see you and don't move.
Trixie does as she is told, and the rest of us walk towards my mother. The rain is relentless now, much heavier than it was only a few moments ago, and so hard that the water seems to be falling up as well as down. Nancy's normally perfect hair is dripping wet and clinging to her face. Her clothes are soaking too. She's clearly been out here for a long time. The rain must have smudged the thick black eyeliner and mascara she always wears. It looks as if she has been crying black tears behind her mask. Even stranger is the sight of her red alarm clock. It is balancing between the branches of the magnolia tree just above her head and still ringing. Connor reaches up to turn it off. The clock says 3 a.m., but it's already 20 minutes past. I can't help wondering if that was why Nancy was never on time for anything. Maybe the clocks she used were wrong. Or maybe someone just wanted to make a point. It seems my mother was late for her own murder. Because I think we all know that's what this was. And that she is dead. Nancy's hands are by her sides and her sleeves have been rolled up. Her left hand is holding on to her beloved copy of The Observer's Book of Wild Flowers, the little green book that she always carried around like a Bible and used to choose our names. Her right hand is holding what looks like a small bunch of lilies, roses, and daisies tied to her fingers with a red ribbon. A string of ivy is wrapped tightly around her neck, not quite covering the silver heart-shaped locket she always wears. It is unclasped to reveal the pictures inside. All this time, I had presumed that it contained two tiny photos of my sisters. But now that it is open, I can only see a tiny black-and-white picture of myself as a child on one side, and a pressed Daisy on the other. Rose slides her gun into her jacket pocket. I find myself replaying Lily's words in the kitchen when she accused Rose of having something to do with all of this, and for a moment I do wonder, as my eldest sister once again takes charge of a situation most people would be overwhelmed by. She leans over Nancy on the bench as though she were a stranger, not our mother, and I can't help noticing that the gun is within my reach. I could take it. Not that I'd know what to do with it. I've never even held a gun before. She's dead, Rose confirms, having checked for a pulse. Lily starts to wail, staring up at the night sky. It is a level of grief and despair that none of us have seen her display before, and nobody knows what to say as a mix of tears and rainwater stream down her face. The sound of ticking is still so loud it makes me think of a cartoon bomb. Connor is holding the red alarm clock that was in the tree, and as he shines the torch on its face, we can all see that something has been written on it. There is always time for truth. What does that mean? I ask. I don't understand what is happening here tonight. Who is doing this and why? Says Lily. I don't know, Rose replies. But I think this confirms it. Confirms what? Someone else did this. It couldn't have been any of us. There is someone else here at Seaglass, and they're killing us one by one. Nancy. Daisy Darker's mother was an actress with the coldest heart. She didn't love all her children and deserved to lose her part. An unexpected pregnancy resulted in marriage and three girls, but instead of loving her family, Nancy longed to see the world. She had wanted to be an actress, but life cast her as a mum instead. Her leading role took its toll and made her want to stay in bed. Her favourite daughter was pretty, and the eldest one was smart. But the youngest child was always a burden, having been born with a broken heart. Nancy blamed herself for this tragedy, though no one understood why. Her guilt made her lonely, bitter, and sad, but she was still unable to cry. When the time came, no one knew who to blame when she was poisoned by her own flowers. By the time she was found, in the rain-soaked grounds, Mrs. Darker had been dead for hours. Chapter 32 Seaglass, 1987. We are getting soaked by the relentless rain as we stand and stare down at my dead mother. And the weather reminds me of the last terrible storm at Seaglass, almost 20 years ago. Nana was planning a big launch for her 10th book at her favourite bookshop. We were all invited, but my father was very busy, as usual, and said he might not be able to be there. So when the telephone rang, we all presumed it was him calling to apologise from whatever corner of the world he was in with his orchestra. But it was a call from the hospital instead, and not about me for a change. My parents were long divorced, but Nancy was still registered as my dad's next of kin, and he'd been in an accident. Most people in the UK can remember the Great Storm of 1987. We've all laughed about the BBC weatherman, Michael Fish, who got the forecast so spectacularly wrong and never lived it down. There's a fantastic clip of what he said that day. Apparently, a lady rang the BBC and said she heard that there was a hurricane on the way.
Well, don't worry, if you're watching, there isn't.
But he was wrong. There was. That October, a hurricane devastated huge parts of the country, and sea glass nearly disappeared beneath the waves for good. Dad had been on the way to join us to celebrate Nana's latest children's book when his car was hit by a falling tree. His visit was meant to be a surprise, but the storm had a bigger one in store.
"I'll be there as soon as I can," Nancy said when the hospital called.
Love always trumps hate when you fear you might lose someone for good. She and Nana left immediately. The book launch was cancelled, and Mr. Kennedy came to look after me and my sisters for the night, along with Connor. One night turned into several. Mr. Kennedy soon ran out of things to do with a house full of children, even though one of them was his own, so when the weather allowed, he encouraged us to spend as much time as possible outside. He taught us about the flowers and plants he and my mother had introduced to sea glass. The magnolia tree wasn't much taller than him back then, but our interest and concentration soon started to fade.
"Gardening is boring," declared Lily, who never liked Connor's dad. She called him the narrow man because he was tall and had grown thin. In some ways, I agreed with her assessment. He did look as though life had squeezed him into wearing only narrow thoughts, jumpers and jeans, almost all of which had pockets and holes in. His words were coated in cynicism, even the kind ones, so I could sort of understand why Lily wanted to stay inside and play on her computer.
"Gardening isn't boring," said Mr. Kennedy, with a strange smile. "One day, you might regret spending your life staring at a screen instead of seeing the real world."
Then he told us a story that was unlike anything I'd heard before.
"Did you know that spies use plants?"
"Like James Bond?" Connor asked.
His father nodded.
"Yes, but in real life. You were all probably too young to remember, but in 1978, a BBC journalist was killed by a poisoned umbrella."
There was a brief silence while we processed his unfamiliar words.
"An umbrella isn't a plant," said Lily.
"Did he open the umbrella indoors?" I asked. "Nana says it's very bad luck to do that."
"No, Daisy," Mr. Kennedy replied. "Someone walked up to him on Waterloo Bridge, pointed the umbrella at his leg, and then the journalist felt a sharp pain."
"Why did someone want to hurt him?" asked Rose.
"Because he defected to the West."
"What does defected mean?" Lily asked.
"Cornwall is in the West," I started to say. Mr. Kennedy shook his head.
"It means that he decided to change sides."
"Like when people get divorced?" I asked.
"Yes, I suppose defecting is a bit like divorce, but even more deadly. The journalist became very ill very quickly. He was taken to hospital, but he died."
"The point of this story is what was on the tip of that umbrella?"
We all stared at him, feeling a little clueless, but then Rose's hand shot up as though she were in class.
"Poison."
"Yes, but where did the poison come from?"
None of us knew the answer to that one.
"The poison on the tip of that umbrella was called ricin, and it came from the seeds of a castor bean plant. The castor bean plant isn't a rare species, or terribly difficult to grow or find. In fact, it can sometimes be found in gardens, just like this one."
Mr. Kennedy pointed at the red and green plant in my mother's garden, and there was a collective and rather dramatic intake of breath.
"So I hope we can all agree that gardening is not boring," he said, looking at Lily. "Plants can be the perfect partners in crime. Do you know why?"
We all shook our heads again.
"Because they'll never grass. Get it?"
His dad jokes were even worse than our father's.
Don't forget to wipe your feet and take your shoes off before going inside the house. You know how much your mother hates muddy footprints.
Later, when we were all back indoors, Mr. Kennedy made himself busy in the kitchen, trying to cook us some sort of dinner. We ate a lot of fish fingers, chips and beans when he was left in charge. As he rummaged about in Nana's freezer, I heard Rose and Connor whispering about him.
"My dad is really upset about your dad," Connor said.
"We're all upset. The doctor Nancy spoke to today said it was serious. Apparently Dad's car is a write-off, and he's lucky to be alive."
"My dad isn't upset about your dad being in hospital. He's upset that Nancy rushed to be by his bedside. They're divorced. They basically defected from each other years ago. She's supposed to be with my dad now."
"I don't think it works like that," Rose said. "When you love someone, you can't just turn it off. There isn't a switch. Even if you hate someone that you once loved, there is still a little bit of love there. Love is like the soil that hate needs in order to grow. I think it's rare in relationships to have one without the other."
16-year-old Rose was ridiculously mature, but I think she might have been born that way. She and Connor were in a relationship of their own. It was almost as though she wanted him to know that she would always love him, even if she hated him one day. Just like our parents. Lily and I watched as Rose held Connor's hand. I could tell it made Lily feel uncomfortable too. When Nancy returned 2 days later, our dad was with her. He needed to rest, and sea glass was where he wanted to do it. His head was bandaged and he had a broken arm. He could have gone to his London home, a flat in Notting Hill, just like my mother could have gone to hers, but she chose to look after him, and he chose to let her. My sisters and I were delighted to have him with us for so long. Rose and Lily even put their feud to one side. They decided to cook together one night, a meal for the whole family, and chose to use one of Nana's recipes for spaghetti bolognese. I wasn't allowed to help them at all, for reasons I didn't understand, but I watched from the doorway. When Lily shouted at me for the 10th time to go away, I sulked in the garden. Rose did almost all of the cooking, chopping onions, carrots, garlic and chili, adding all the herbs to the meat, tomatoes and stock. She grated cheese and, because this is one of Nana's recipes, had a bowl of hundreds and thousands ready to sprinkle on top. All Lily did was open a packet of dried spaghetti and pour some boiling water over it in a saucepan. We sat down in our individually painted chairs when dinner was served, but I didn't take a bite. Instead, I just waited. My mother put a fork full of spaghetti into her mouth and spat it out seconds later. My father swallowed his, but then drank an entire glass of water. Nobody took more than one bite. I'd helped with the meal after all, adding a full jar of hot chili powder and a bottle of hot chili sauce to the spaghetti. Lily blamed Rose and Rose blamed Lily. I think only Nana guessed that it was me. Apart from the occasional sibling-shaped squabble, we were happier than we had ever been before. But not everyone was pleased to see the Darker family reunited. It was the beginning of the end for Nancy and Mr. Kennedy. He was furious about the new living arrangements and didn't hide it well. He stayed away from sea glass the entire time that my dad was there. Days turned into weeks, and weeks stretched into months. Nancy's garden was neglected. The flowers faded, wilted, and died. But she barely noticed. During that time, while my dad recovered, we were like a real family again. We spent time together playing board games. Cluedo was a firm favourite. Went for walks along the coast and watched old movies. Dad, unable to play his beloved piano, completed lots of jigsaw puzzles with just the one hand. And Nana cooked a lot of her special chicken soup. It was what she made whenever one of us was ill. The secret ingredient was mashed banana, and the soup was always served with homemade crusty bread slathered in Nutella.
We were a real happy family for a while, and I thought we might stay that way forever. Christmas in 1987 was very much a darker family affair, and everyone was a little more grateful for what we all had. Not that the sentiment lasted. Gratitude tends to go off quicker than milk in our house. Chapter 33. 31st of October, 3:30 a.m. Less than 3 hours until low tide.
We need to get Nancy inside, says Connor. We can't leave her out here in the rain.
I realise I have drifted back in time again. Life feels a bit like a movie at the moment. Maybe when the present is too painful, it's only natural to disappear inside flashbacks of happier times. It reminds me of something Nana used to say. If you spend your present focusing on your past, you will never change your future.
Why is someone doing this to us? Lily asks again,
and Rose is the only one to answer.
We need to keep it together for just a couple more hours until low tide. You and Trixie are going to be okay. Do you hear me?
Lily looks more vacant than usual.
Lily, do you hear me?
She still doesn't answer.
Do me a favour and go inside. I want you to find your diabetic kit and check your blood sugar. We all need to be well enough to leave when the tide goes out.
Okay, says Lily. She looks like a person who has had their plug pulled out and is surviving on a dwindling battery.
Can you wait a couple of minutes before you bring Nancy indoors? I don't want Trixie to see her like this. She's already seen far more than she should have tonight. I'll get her back into the lounge and keep her there while you do whatever you have to do.
Rose nods, and Lily walks towards the doorway where Trixie is waiting. Then Rose stares down at the small bouquet tied to Nancy's hand. I sometimes think our mother named us all after flowers because that's what she wished we were. Flowers are much easier to pick and arrange and cut down to size than daughters. I can tell I'm not the only one who thinks that was a strange thing to say, given the circumstances. Connor looks equally puzzled.
We need to move her inside, he says again.
Are you sure we should? Rose asks, and Connor looks a little shocked.
Shouldn't we be trying to preserve evidence for the police? Isn't that what a crime correspondent would say next? You're probably getting some kind of sick thrill out of all this. I bet you can't wait to call the news desk. Maybe this will help your career. I know you're upset, but none of this is my fault, he says.
Isn't it? Rose asks. She looks at him for a long time, then shrugs.
Fine, let's move her. She's dead. We can't really make matters any worse. Where do you suggest we move her to?
They stare at each other, and I feel as though I'm intruding on something I don't fully understand.
We could put her with the others, Connor suggests.
Rose doesn't reply straight away. Apprehension is the mother of our mistakes and tries to warn us before we make them, but we don't always listen to our mothers.
I suppose that makes sense, Rose says eventually, sounding as though she doesn't really believe it.
She's quietly crying now. We can keep them all together, but out of sight until the police come. I'll take this end, you take the other, she says to Connor. And we all bow our heads against the rain as we make our way towards the house. Carrying my mother seems to slow Connor and Rose down more than it should, and they fall behind. I can hear the two of them whispering again, but the sound of the wind and waves in the distance steals their words from my ears. Something is different when I step into the kitchen, and it takes me a moment to realise what. The muddy footprints have been mopped up. It's a strange thing for Lily to have done.
She's the untidiest person I've ever met, and I'm not convinced she'd know what end of a mop to use if I gave her one.
Maybe she is just trying to protect Trixie from everything that has happened tonight, in whatever way that she can. I can hear them quietly talking in the lounge.
Rose appears in the kitchen doorway behind me. She is holding my mother's feet, and Connor is carrying Nancy beneath her arms. They are soaked to the skin, and I feel as though I am not doing enough to help. I step aside as they struggle past me, heading for the cupboard beneath the stairs. We all try not to look at Dad and Nana's bodies as they carefully lower Nancy beside them. When Connor's hand accidentally grazes Rose's fingers, she pulls away as though he has burned her.
Rose, I just want to say that I'm so very sorry.
For what?
All of it, Connor says,
and she frowns at him.
I just mean that I know what it's like to lose a parent, and it's okay to be upset.
This is not the same as what happened in your family,
she replies,
and Connor looks like he's been slapped in the face. We never knew for sure whether Connor's dad started drinking again because he thought my parents were getting back together. The tree that fell on my dad's car during the great storm of 1987 did more damage than anyone first thought. Dad ended up staying at Seaglass for a couple of months while he recovered, which meant Mr. Kennedy stayed away. Nancy spoke to him on the phone, but the next time we all saw him, he was very different from the man we thought we knew. He arrived uninvited and unexpected at Seaglass one day, demanding to see Connor. We all heard what he said.
This is not your family. I am your family, and I don't want you coming here anymore.
I was too young to understand that he was drunk. We found out afterwards that he had lost his gardening job with the National Trust. It wasn't long before Connor started regularly running away from home again and turning up at Seaglass at odd times. But he was almost 18 by then, and better able to defend himself. Nancy ended her relationship with Mr. Kennedy, and I think that everything that happened afterwards broke what was left of her heart. A few months later, Connor left home for good, and none of us ever saw his father again.
Are those your boots?
Rose asks, looking at the front door. Connor and I both follow her stare and see the pair of large, muddy men's boots in the hallway. I'm sure they weren't there before. He shakes his head.
No.
Chapter 34. 31st of October, 3:45 a.m. Less than 3 hours until low tide.
Someone clearly left them here deliberately, says Connor. These boots are not mine.
Someone mopped the kitchen floor too, says Rose. Connor frowns.
What?
There were muddy footprints in the kitchen before we all went outside and found Nancy in the garden. Now the floor is clean, Rose replies. I thought Lily might have done it, I say.
It would have been easy enough for Lily to come back inside, send Trixie into the lounge to watch TV, then clean up the mess while we were still out there. Rose agrees. But why would she?
Connor says.
Have you ever known Lily to clean or tidy anything before?
Rose shakes her head. Connor takes a step closer and lowers his voice.
Maybe you're right. Maybe there is someone else here. What if there isn't? You can't possibly think that Lily is behind all of this, Rose whispers. I don't know what to think anymore, Connor replies. It's only 15 minutes until the top of the hour. I say we keep a close eye on Lily until then. I think she's been acting strangely all night. I think you're wrong, but okay. I need to get dry first, though, Rose says.
Connor stares at her wet clothes, then at his own.
You sure you'll be okay alone?
She gives him a look involving one raised eyebrow.
Fine. Shall we meet here in 5 minutes?
We all go our separate ways. And something feels wrong as Rose disappears inside Nana's little library where she slept last night. I wouldn't want to be alone right now. But I suppose she does have a gun, and Rose has always been very good at taking care of herself. Connor and I head towards the stairs, and the wooden punch clock by the front door catches my eye on the way. The cards in the cubby holes next to it remind me of old-fashioned paper library cards. They are not just for visiting family and friends. There are some other names written on them too. Nana made everyone punch in and out. It was one of her many quirks. It was also something that used to annoy Connor's father, along with all the other things that he got so upset about. I spot a card with another familiar name. It's sticking out and at an angle. According to the time and date stamped on it, Nana's agent was here at Seaglass yesterday, just a few hours before I arrived. There is no stamp for when he left, but maybe he just forgot to punch out. Upstairs, Connor grabs some dry clothes from his bag, then disappears down the hall, presumably to change in the bathroom. Seeing him in my bedroom is still a surreal experience, and I'm relieved to have a couple of minutes to myself. I try and fail to gather my thoughts, but I'm scared of what might happen next. I don't say a word when Connor returns and starts packing his things as though getting ready to leave. He forgets his laptop, though, and I see that it is still open on the desk in the corner of the room. The word boo that I typed last night seems in poor taste now, even if today is Halloween. I could tell that Connor was genuinely worried about Rose when we were downstairs, even after all these years, and don't quite know what to make of it. He doesn't ask if I'm all right, but I try not to hold it against him. Sometimes other people can see when a couple are in love long before they can see it for themselves, and that's how things were between Rose and Connor for years when we were children. But they were inseparable after that first kiss in the cupboard under the stairs. A long-distance relationship followed, and it continued even when Connor was stuck here in Cornwall and Rose was away at school. They were always writing and calling each other, and I confess I felt jealous. I wonder if we are all just echoes of the people we might have been if life had unfolded differently. The byproducts of a crease in time. Sometimes I think Rose and Connor fell in love the first time they saw each other on the beach when they were both 9 and Nana invited him to come to Seaglass for lemonade. Something happened that day. It wasn't something you could see or explain, but it was there. You could feel it. I often wonder whether we are born with love in our hearts and whether life just slowly erases it, eating it away little by little, until all the empathy and warmth is completely rubbed out. We learn to love regardless of whether there is anyone in our lives to teach us how. Love is as instinctive as breathing, but we don't have to give it away. Like our breath, we can hold on to it if we choose to, but not forever, because then it starts to hurt. I wasn't the only one who was jealous of their relationship. When Connor turned 18, Rose gave him her virginity as a birthday gift wrapped in black lace underwear. Lily, who already felt a bit abandoned, was furious. Connor was the only boy in Black Sand Bay who Lily really wanted to fool around with, and the only boy she hadn't. And she wasn't the only one secretly in love with her sister's boyfriend. The eldest sibling inevitably wins most of life's unspoken races. Rose was the first to fall in love, but also the first to experience the sorrow and grief of breaking up. When Connor says something in the present, it's so unexpected, I jump. Daisy. I can't imagine how awful it would feel to see what is happening to your family tonight. He's speaking to me. After all these years of him acting like I don't exist, I am overcome with emotion. I just wish it hadn't taken something so awful for him to forgive me. Thank you, I say. Connor sits down on my bed right next to me, and I'm a little girl again, in love with a boy who never really noticed her.
I blamed you for what happened all those years ago for such a long time, he says. But it wasn't your fault. I know that now. Deep down, I always knew. And I'm sorry for everything that has happened since.
Tears are streaming down my face. I've waited so long for him to say these words. It's okay, I say, and consider reaching for his hand. But the sound of a door slamming downstairs interrupts the moment and it is lost. Connor's face is now filled with fear, and I imagine my own must look the same. We hurry back down the staircase and see that the muddy boots are gone. Connor knocks on the closed library door where Rose said she was getting changed, but nobody answers. I feel a strange sensation, like when your heart skips a beat, but it's more than that. He's about to knock a second time when Rose opens the door. She has changed into a white t-shirt, and clearly isn't wearing a bra, along with another pair of skin-tight jeans. The jacket is gone, and she has untied her long dark hair so that it falls down past her shoulders in damp, wavy curls. Something unspoken passes between the two of them, and I feel like a spare part again. We left the back door open and I think the wind slammed it shut, Rose says, answering the question before we ask it. Then the clocks in the hallway start to chime, and they sound even louder than before. What is that? Rose asks, looking over my shoulder. Connor and I turn and see what she is staring at. The door on the front of the grandfather clock, the largest of the 80 different varieties of clock in the hall, is open. And there is what looks like another VHS tape covering its face. My mind whirs like all the clocks I'm surrounded by, and just as loudly. Lily and Trixie could have put the tape there while the three of us went to get changed. Or Rose could have put it there while Connor and I were upstairs. Or Connor could have put it there when he left the bedroom. Or someone else could have done it while we were all distracted, then let themselves out the back door. For a moment, I can't decide what is worse. The idea that a stranger is here doing this to us, or that it might be one of the family. Unpleasant thoughts tend to outstay their welcome, just like unpleasant people. I stare at Connor and Rose and can see that they are thinking the same thing, wondering if they can trust each other or anyone here at Seaglass. They both reach for the tape at the same time, their hands grazing just like they did before. I'm not imagining the chemistry between them, and it's making me feel a bit peculiar. I know I have no right to feel anything at all, and there are far more important things to worry about. But the last of my nerves are being gotten on, and I feel sick with fear. When Rose picks up the latest VHS tape, I feel even worse. The cover has a new message spelled out in Scrabble letters stuck to the front of it. See me. There's no time to explain or argue, says Rose, speaking at Lily as she marches into the lounge. We found another tape, or rather another tape was left for us to find. I think we need to see what's on it as soon as possible, before anything else happens to anyone here. Lily doesn't disagree. I think all the fight has gone out of her, because she doesn't say a word. She and Trixie are huddled together on the sofa nearest the television, and I can tell that my niece has been crying again. An image of one of Nana's birthdays here at Seaglass fills the screen, and I instantly remember that night 16 years ago. It's a night I've always wished I could forget.